Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Alexis the midwife.
And I'm Becky the doula.
Welcome to Notes from the Mother Box, where we will be having real and frank conversations about the highs and lows of the parenting journey.
Today we have a very special guest join us to talk about baby loss. And whilst these conversations are hard and can be triggering for some, we feel that they are important and that these angel babies need to be remembered. But please do be kind to yourself and only listen if you are feeling well and strong enough to hear emotional conversation.
Today we welcome Faye Ansell. Faye lost her son to a rare disease called A&E in March 2020 and has built up Grayson's legacy support since then with her partner and Grayson's dad, Craig. Faye bravely reached out to us to talk about her family and building up a legacy for her beautiful boy Grayson. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today, Faye.
Thank you.
It's an honour to have you on the show, darling.
And I have to say, because we were obviously looking on your website, and what a beautiful boy. His eyes.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Gorgeous. Just, I mean, I'm biased, but he was just, he was and is and always will be just absolutely incredible.
Stunning. Yeah. Very, very wise eyes, doesn't he? Yes. You sort of look and you're like, oh, very knowing.
Yes.
So we saw that Grayson was born on the 19th of May 2019.
Yeah.
And you described having the most incredible pregnancy, a magical birth, and a healthy, happy baby boy.
Yes.
If you can you take us back to your pregnancy and birth? What was it like for you?
Absolutely. So it like I say, it was an incredible pregnancy. I just felt the best I've ever felt. It was just incredible. I just felt like I was glowing throughout the whole, you know, the whole pregnancy. The first couple of I knew I was pregnant because I was snacking so much. I sort of just had the hunger snacks. And the ladies at my work were like, yeah, we knew something was going on, Faye, because you just like slyly opened up your drawer and was nibbling on ginger nut biscuits, you know, that sort of thing. But I didn't complain once during my pregnancy. I just had the most amazing pregnancy. And he was supposed to be due on the 10th of May. And of course, he didn't come then. I think I went in for two sweeps in the end. And then we did all the, you know, trying the raspberry leaf tea and sex and all of that business.
Yeah.
And it eventually happened. And my contractions started at home. And I went in because, as you know, as they say, if they're a minute apart and they're lasting for 2 minutes, and that happened quite quickly. But when I went in, they was like, no, you're only a centimetre. No, you're only three centimetres.
It's so hard, isn't it? And you're like, how?
How am I? But I kind of managed it really well. And I didn't put too much pressure on myself. I just, you know, when the midwife said to me, you know, what's your birth plan? I was like, him being here safely. You know, I couldn't care less which way that is, but I just want him here safely. And they were like, amazing. That's what we want. I said, if I can have a water birth, great. If not, it's not a problem. So I was sent home and I was having contractions all through the night, and my mum came round and Craig and her were sort of taking it in turns to sleep. And I was just kind of resting on the windowsill, rocking myself as you do. And then in the early mornings, I said, I've not really felt him move very much. So I called the unit and they said, come in and we'll check. And
yeah,
they checked and I think I was about 4.5 centimetres at this point. And I was like, we're going to keep you in. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard to kind of get his heartbeat. They wasn't kind of getting the position right. And they was like, we can't put you in, you know, for a water birth. I think you just need to be monitored a little bit. But yeah, it was all absolutely fine. That was in the early hours of the morning, I think about 5-6 o'clock. And then sort of I was just having contractions during the day. They sort of said, lay down on the bed. And of course the contractions stopped. And I was like, yeah, no, yeah. I want to stand up. But I was hooked onto a monitor, so I couldn't really go far. So I was just kind of like dawdling around the bed. I just had gas and air, which I was, you know, really proud about.
Amazing,
and
yeah.
That kind of was just at the last stages when mm-hmm. that mooing came, it was really weird. So my mum and Craig, they still say it now. I was kind of just resting on the side of the bed and then I just dropped to the floor and was like, and I was like, and then I just stood up and went, what happened there? Like, literally, what happened?
Yeah. It's so instinctive, isn't it? You sort of almost, you know, we do all this training, but actually your body naturally makes you do what it needs, doesn't it?
Yeah. And do you know what? I say it now, even when I speak to, you know, I've had a few friends that have had babies after, and I've just said, you know, and I said, the only way I can describe it is when you need to be sick and your body pushes it up, it's in reverse.
Yeah.
And they're like, wow, that's, you know, that's the only way I can describe it, is literally in reverse. And yeah, and then after a couple of pushes, I sort of laid on the bed and I've got a curved cervix. So he just kind of got caught there a little bit. Yeah. So they helped me, they did a cut. And then they kind of pushed the button, which everyone went into panic mode and I was still sort of chin deep in, you know, the pushes. Yeah. Didn't even notice. My mum was stood behind Craig just crying her eyes out. So I'm one of six. So she kind of was like,
oh, wow.
they've pushed the button, that this means, you know, this is serious sort of thing. But it wasn't. They just all came in. Everyone took their places, which was just great. And I didn't know any different, you know.
Yeah.
And they did a little snip and he came out. Yeah. It was just incredible. And yeah, just the most amazing feeling. And he was absolutely perfect in every way. Absolutely perfect.
Oh, he looks absolutely perfect. Gorgeous. And then you go home as a family, and we all have that experience where you take this little bundle home with you and you're like, oh my goodness, now we're a family and we've got this little person and we've got to look after them. What was the postnatal period like for you and Craig?
Do you know what, I really struggled. And I'm very open and honest about that. So I've worked in childcare my whole life. So I'm a qualified child carer, one of six, always wanted to be a mama, you know, knew that I wanted that. I was always sort of the sibling that always looked after all the other children and really helped my mum out. And my mum was sort of a single parent for the majority of her life. I just knew that that was what I wanted to do, but it was a shock. It was an absolute shock to me. So Craig does shift work over at the airport. So he does sort of 4-on-4 often. He was doing nights and days. Mm. And yeah, I struggled. I massively struggled. And I didn't think I expected it. And when I speak to people, they go, no, you didn't. You was an absolute amazing mum. And I'm happy to admit I really did struggle, because it was, like you say, that he relied on me for everything. He had a tongue tie which didn't get picked up on for quite a while, so we struggled quite a lot with sleeping and feeding and everything like that. And I was sleep deprived, which I didn't think I'd ever be, because I've always been a horrendous sleeper myself, and I just struggled being on my own, you know, during the day.
Understandable, Faye.
Yeah, and I'd sort of always worked since I was 16. You know, when I was doing my my childcare course, I was working three jobs around that. And to all of a sudden not be working, it was alien to me. I was like, I don't like this. You know, I'm not working. I didn't feel like I was doing anything, you know. And I know I was a mummy, but I didn't feel like I had a purpose. You know, it was a really strange sensation. But sort of after those first couple of months, it then started to change when I got out and about and we were starting to do classes and, you know, just things eased up a little bit of those sort of those newborn stages as such.
I think that is so normal. And Becky and I certainly felt the same.
Yeah, I'd supported women for years and years, supporting women. And you think you know it all. And then suddenly you're like, I don't know anything. You know, I've never, because when it's you doing it, it's very different, isn't it, to looking after somebody else or somebody else's exactly. baby. You're like, what?
yeah, exactly that. And I just constantly doubted myself. I doubted myself that I was enough for him, and was I doing enough to make him happy? And, you know, just all of that sort of stuff. And also I wanted to keep Faye.
Yes.
You know, and that's why sort of we you know, we had always planned that when we were starting our family, that I would always go back to work, because I wanted that little bit of me. And I didn't feel like, you know, I was trying to do everything. You know, I'm a bit of a clean freak. So by the time Craig got home, I wanted to be this perfect person. If I still cleaned the house and I had the dinner on the table for him and all the washing was done, and, you know, we was all bubbly and happy. And actually what it was is, when Craig walked through the door, I handed Grayson over to him and just broke down in tears half the time. Yeah. And Craig's like, what's the matter with you? And I was like, I just need to go and make the dinner, because I just need that. Time for myself, you know.
I know, it's difficult to describe it, isn't it, when you're with the baby all the time. And I think it's funny you say that thing about the dinner. I remember some parents that I taught antenatal classes to saying to me, when her partner came in the evening, he thought he was being helpful by saying, you know what, you just sit down and relax with the baby and I'll make dinner for you. And she was like, no, you take the baby. I'm going to pour myself a glass of wine and make dinner and listen to a podcast.
Exactly.
And I'm going to do that for 20 minutes. I'd rather you didn't come and disturb me during that time. And I think that's absolutely okay. And that gives you a little bit of time out to recharge your batteries just a tiny bit. And it's those little micro moments of looking after yourself, I think, that make a huge difference. And also the other thing I just want to come back to quickly is that you said that you had these expectations of being this amazing mum because of all your experience, and then you felt like you weren't. You were. You were absolutely were. And I think we all feel like that in those postnatal days, but you're exactly what Grayson needed, of course.
And I sort of know that now, and I've kind of been through that. I've punished myself quite a lot, especially in this past year. I've punished myself that I couldn't do more for him. He was my baby and I should have been able to protect him. And I now know that there was nothing I could do, and there was nothing the doctors and nurses could have done. You know, so how could have I done anything different? So
we do like to punish ourselves as mothers, don't we? That's one thing. If I could take anything away from any mum, is that that kind of self-punishing that we do.
Yes.
But so we've seen the little video you have on your website, on Grayson's Legacy website, that Craig put together. And this is a little baby, Grayson. And if anyone goes to your website, we'll put the information in the show notes so that they can see it. There's a beautiful, beautiful little video that Craig, I think Craig's made it, and he's speaking over, isn't he? And there's footage of you as a family with Grayson, and he was the cheekiest little chap, wasn't he?
He really, really was, honestly.
And laughing all the time. Like, I was actually laughing along with him when I was watching it. I was like,
He just was the most smiley baby, you know. Of course he had his moments. Absolutely.
Yeah, they all do. I love the bit where he climbs into the dishwasher.
I know,
and he gives you that, they all do it, don't they? They give you that look of like, what? Like,
yeah.
And you know what the thing was, is I was hanging out washing at that point, and you can hear me in the background going, Grayson, down, get down. And he's like, but dad's let me up here. Dad was emptying the dishwasher and he's purposely left the door open for me to climb on. Whereas you, mum, you really quickly whip the door up. Dad hasn't, he's left it open for me to climb in. I'm gonna do it.
Oh, fun dads.
Literally.
So funny.
But yeah, no, he just was, he you know, it was something that we wanted really on, like, I mean, he was born in the May and my birthday was the 28th of June. And so he was, what, only 6 weeks at that point. And we spent a night away from him. You know, we went to the cinema, we had a meal out, and he slept, you know, he slept over at Nana's house. And and I said that from the very, very, you know, start, I don't want to make this hard on him, because I knew as a parent I needed to go back to work, which meant he was going to go into nurseries. And obviously I'd worked in nurseries for 8 years. So I know how difficult that can be. And I was like, I just want to make it easy on him. I want him to be enjoyed by as many people as he can. Like, I know we're his parents and I want him all to myself, but I also want him to be enjoyed by so many people. So from the very sort of offset, he was with people. You know, I would go to my mum's house and just go out to the shops and he would stay there, or my sister would come over. You know, we wanted that. And I'm so grateful that I did that now, because they got to experience that time with him.
Yeah,
and it sounds like you have a gorgeous family, a lovely big family.
Our family is actually, I've got a really, really small family. Obviously, there's six siblings, but we are a really small family. But yeah, we've always been really close. We've had quite a lot to deal with as a family, you know, in terms of sort of our past and growing up and things. And yeah, I think Grayson's death has definitely brought us closer, you know. It's one of the things that's come out of it that's most probably a positive, and that sounds ridiculous to say, but it is.
But these things, they do make you sort of pull together, don't they? So
absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about when Grayson became poorly? Like, how did you realise he was unwell?
Yeah, so on the Tuesday before Grayson passed away, he woke up with a high temperature, and he was teething. He was cutting both of his top teeth and had been for a while, but you know, you could really see them at that stages of really pushing through. And he had rosy cheeks and snotty nose and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So you put it down to teething, as you do.
Of course,
and you know, I gave him Calpol and ibuprofen, and it brought the temperature right down, and he was still fine in himself. You know, he was eating fine, he was playing, you know, he was a really lovable baby, but also he would always get up to mischief, you know, so he'd want to be on his own exploring. And so that went on for 2 days, but he was having the Calpol and the ibuprofen, and it was bringing it back down. He was sleeping well at night time. He was still eating really well. He was a really big foodie, which I absolutely loved about him. He loved his food. And on the Thursday, he woke up and his temperature was very, very slight. It wasn't as high as it had been, but he was quite groggy and he just wanted to lay on us. And I was like, he's still not quite right. So maybe he's fighting a bit of a viral infection. And we went throughout the day. He had his normal lunch. He then had his sleep after lunch. And when he woke up, he sort of was just laying on me and he just sat up and just vomited everywhere. And I thought, this isn't right. We'll call the doctors and see if we can get an appointment. So this was about 3:30 in the afternoon. And I called the doctor, and obviously, because I mean, COVID was around, obviously it was very well known, but we hadn't yet gone into lockdown at that point. So our doctor said, oh, we'll do a video call with you. And at this point, by the time they had called back, he had gone back down for a sleep. So they said, oh, can you just sort of wake him up and lift up his vest and we'll check his breathing? And of course, he woke up and he was giving the doctor all the smiles on the camera and just wanted to keep grabbing the phone and kissing it. And they just said, yeah, we think he's fighting a viral infection, or we think it might be a throat infection, hence why he's vomited. So what we'll do is give him overnight. If his temperature spikes again, we'll just prescribe you antibiotics in the morning. Yeah. And I said, okay, that's fine. And we decided to set up camp downstairs because he had already vomited over the carpet downstairs. So I just thought, instead of spreading it around the bedrooms, we'll just set up camp downstairs. And we set up his travel cot, and he didn't want to be in it. He just wanted to be with us. So we kind of took it in turns during the night to have him laying on us. And since he had vomited, he kind of was in and out of a sleep, which I now know was a semi-conscious state, which comes with the A&E. It kind of kills me to know that, and that we hadn't got him further into the hospital at that point.
But you wouldn't have known, would you? Because the thing is, like you say, all babies get viruses, and it's exactly, you know, they get a fever, they're a bit sleepy, they vomit, you know, there's no way that you would have known it could have been anything more, could you?
No, exactly. And he, at this point, he hadn't had obviously any dinner because he was just in and out of his sleep. And the doctor said, if he wants food or if he wants a bottle, just give it to him and see how he goes. So at 10 o'clock, he sort of woke up for a period of time and he was quite alert. So we made I think it was a 4-ounce bottle, because he was having like he was having like a dinner and then still an 8-ounce bottle at nighttime. You know, he really liked his food and he was a chubby little one. So I gave him 4 ounces and I thought, let's just see if he keeps that down. And he did, and he went back to sleep, and then he woke up at midnight, so gave him another 4 ounces, because bearing in mind he hadn't had his afternoon bottle, his dinner and his evening milk at that point. So I gave him another 4 ounces, took it, went back to sleep. And then in the early hours of the morning, so this was time-wise, I think it was about 3:30 in the morning, he woke up and he had this high-pitched cry with no tears. Mm-hmm. And the doctor had sent us a sepsis information when we had spoke to her the day before. And she said, it's just something to look out for. Mm. And that was obviously one of the common signs of sepsis. Yeah. So I thought, this isn't right. We're going to call for an ambulance. So we called 999 and they didn't deem him as, you know, as needing an ambulance. They said his breathing's fine. And once again, I think it was down to COVID. They were, you know, they just weren't coming out. So they said, we're going to put you through to an emergency doctor. They'll give you a call back. And about 15 minutes later, a doctor called back and they said, is that him crying in the background? And we said, yes. And they said, is that his usual cry? And we was like, no, it's not. And he said, okay. He said, what I suggest you do is just pack up a bag, take his bottles with you and just get yourself down to A&E. So we kind of did that as, and he physically didn't want to go down. He wanted to be there. So Craig ran upstairs, got in his, you know, trackies, grabbed a few bits together for Craig. And then I did the same. And I got him in his car seat and I sat next to him in the car and he was sort of, the high-pitched cry continued and Craig really put his foot down and he just, his crying stopped and then his eyes just looked out to the window and he started to have a seizure. Mm-hmm. And I just ripped him out the car seat and I just said to Craig, go, I need you to get us to the hospital. And we were literally about 3 miles from the hospital at this point. And I said to Craig, throw me the phone and I'm going to call 999 to say we're on our way.
Yeah.
And they said, we need you to pull over and we need to get an ambulance to you because Grayson will get seen quicker if an ambulance comes to you than you getting to the hospital because you're going to have to explain everything a million times when you get to the hospital. So I was like, but it would have taken us not even 5 minutes to get to the hospital. So we pulled over on the side and he continued to have a seizure and I was holding him. And ambulance were driving past and we were flagging them and we were getting out and waving and they just kept driving and they weren't going anywhere. They didn't have the lights on. And I was like, an ambulance has just driven past and they're going, it's not for you. It's not for you. What was really frustrating is the ambulance that came had actually come from a more local hospital, but they don't have a pediatric unit there.
Right.
So I was like, if they had come to us at our house, they would have got to us quicker. You know, but obviously that's all the what ifs and you try not to go there all the time. And the ambulance came about 10 minutes later, so we would have been at the hospital even you know, before that, but an ambulance came and I just ran into the back of the ambulance with him and they gave him some anti-seizure drugs which did calm down the physical seizure, actually physically, but they don't believe that it stopped internally. And Craig got in the car and drove to the hospital and I was in the ambulance with Grayson. And the reason that they said is they, because of COVID, they had a bed set up in resus for him. He didn't need resuscitating, but they had a bed, you know, set up for him with doctors and nurses all around. And we just went straight into resus, which we was told that we wouldn't have done that if we had carried on the journey. And they did what they needed to do. They took various bloods and all of that and nothing. His bloods were clear. They were all perfect. Goodness. They could see absolutely no signs of anything. And after a while, they gave him the drugs that kind of bring you around out of a seizure. And they brought the anaesthetist down and they said, we really need him to come around. And at this point, Craig's dad and my mum had come down to the hospital. They said, you know, we really need to kind of give him a shake, give him a good shake and, you know, cool him, you know, that sort of thing. So we was doing that and he started to come around. He was doing a few really big coughs and they was like, that's what we need him to do. We need him. He wasn't pumping out enough carbon dioxide. Right. He was, you know, so they were like, we really need him to do that. His blood pressure was perfect. All of his blood works were great. They didn't see anything in that. And he kind of was coughing, and then he just stopped. And they was just like, he's just not pumping out enough carbon dioxide. We really need him to do that. So they took him down for a scan. And they said that they saw some really small abnormalities on the left side of his brain. And he had a localized seizure. So all of the right side of his body was where the seizure was at. So there were some minor, small abnormalities on the left side of his brain, which they said you generally will see in a child that has had a seizure. And they said, we're going to speak to John Radcliffe because obviously they're a they're a sort of a neurology department and specialist, and we may get him transferred over. And they had the chat and they sent the scans over, and they just said, he's not bringing himself around. We think he's still seizuring, because they were lifting up his eyes and they were still sort of moving quite rapidly. And they said, I think we're going to intubate him and move him. And I kind of didn't really know what that meant. And because of COVID, it was really difficult. Like, we couldn't go down with him. To be completely honest, we most probably shouldn't have even been in the room. You know, they shouldn't have allowed Craig's dad and my mum in at that point as well. And what we later found out is that actually what John Radcliffe saw on the scans was a very, very sick brain and a very unwell baby. But what we were being told is that it was very minor. And we were actually told from a member of the team that we'll see you in a couple of weeks. He'll be back here, you know, and there's nothing to worry about. And this is what, you know, this is what we often see. So yes, they took him down to be intubated, and we had to just kind of sit in the cafe, and they took us down to a little room and said, showed us a brochure and said, this is what you're going to see of Grayson when we put him in the ambulance. And I'm really sorry, neither of you can come in the ambulance with us, because they had carried out a COVID test on Grayson at this point and hadn't yet got the results. And it was hideous to look and see. And the only way we saw Grayson just as they wheeled him out of the hospital and put him into the ambulance. And of course, that wasn't nice to see.
Oh, awful.
But they put him into the ambulance and they said, you know, he's going to go to the best place and just follow behind or go home, get some stuff and then come to the hospital, because they do need to get him settled. So you won't be able to see him immediately. So my mum went back to our house and got us, and of course we just followed straight behind. You know, we didn't want to go home. And Grayson was taken to Piku once he reached John Radcliffe, and Piku and Niku had been split up, so the children that had a COVID test but hadn't yet got the results were taken to Piku, and all the children that were there were taken to Niku once they had their results back. And we went straight up to Piku, and it was really strange. John Radcliffe was empty. It was like a ghost town. And we went up there, so this was Friday at this point. So we got to Stoke Mandeville Hospital at about 6 a.m in the morning, and he was transferred at about 10:30, 11. And we didn't get to see Grayson until 10:30 that night. And we were put in a little family room, and doctors kept coming and introducing themselves on different shifts. And they were trying to explain that what they had seen on the scans at Stoke Mandeville Hospital were now very, very different here, and that they were trying to get him settled and on the various monitors.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They came to get us at 10:30 and they said, oh, you can come and see your baby boy. And just before we headed in, they said, we're just going to take you into this side room. And obviously at that point, you know, something isn't right. And we had a member of the nursing team, the Piku sort of main head doctor and a neurologist sat with masks on across the table. And the neurologist just, her eyes filled, and she just said to us, I'm really sorry, I don't know what's taking your baby boy. And she was 30 years in practice. No. She said, I don't know what's taking your baby boy. I'm just about to go on a call with 8 other doctors from around the UK. Grayson is severely brain dead, and he has whatever is taking him is causing severe brain damage, and we are going to give him a course of IVIG, which is immunoglobulin globulin, I think that's, and it's basically immunity from other people's bodies. At that point, we were told that what had happened was irreversible. Mm-hmm. If Grayson was to make it through and the IVIG was to help him, he would be severely brain dead for the rest of his life. He most probably wouldn't be able to walk, talk, or eat again. And his body would make that decision for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we then went to see him. And of course, you can see him laying there, and it wasn't he just wasn't the boy that we brought in.
Yeah.
And yeah, they just said that they hadn't ever seen a case of this at John Radcliffe before. So the neurologist went away and had her meeting, and she came back and called us in and said, we believe that Grayson has A&E, which is abbreviated for acute necrotizing encephalopathy of childhood. I still don't fully understand it myself. Yeah. You know, we're a year in and I still don't fully understand what it is. But the test showed that Grayson had a mutation of his RAMBP2 gene, which obviously all of our genes carry and proteins that obviously are vital for our bodies. And the RAMBP2 gene makes up the proteins for those vital organs such as your brain and your liver. Grayson had this genetic mutation. And what is really, really difficult is that having that genetic mutation doesn't, Grayson may never have been affected by it. And what's really hard is that, I mean, Grayson was a healthy baby boy. He had bronchiolitis in the October before, and we actually ended up going to the hospital on like two occasions with that because of his breathing was so shallow and deep. And he was actually more ill then in the October than he was this time round. And I said, how did that not happen in October? And the problem with A&E is that they don't know. There's no time frame that they can put on it that it was that, you know, it was that point that triggered the A&E. And that's really hard to, I suppose, come to terms with. Because you then, you know, I was saying to the doctors, so when did the A&E trigger? Did the A&E trigger when we was in the car journey, when he had the seizure? Or was it on the Tuesday? Had he just been going downhill and it had been taking his brain since the Tuesday? And they don't know, they can't pinpoint it. They don't know what, you know, what that trigger is that triggers the A&E. And some people, well, we all live with gene mutations, but some of them do absolutely nothing at all. And this mutation just so happened that it, you know, what he had a viral infection, which they believe was influenza A or influenza B, which is flu, and they believe that there was just something that just took those levels over that triggered the A&E. And the seizure was his brain going, I can't cope no more. Yeah. I can't cope with the level of the temperature change and what's happening. And obviously that's why the seizure triggered, and that's why that happened. So we were told that, and we were told that there is no treatment for A&E. There is a 30% mortality rate, and 10% of cases have no effect whatsoever. You know, they will be, you know, as severe as Grayson was, and then they will just all of a sudden come out of a coma and be absolutely fine. You know, with no long-lasting effects. So it's really difficult, because when you read the stories for A&E, they're all very familiar, you know, they're all very similar in terms of what happens. And then when you see the outcomes of some of them, it's like nothing ever happened. And I'm thinking, why wasn't that Grayson?
Yeah, that must have felt so unfair, honestly.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and then you do read the cases, and I'm in contact with quite a few of the families where, you know, they are living with severe brain damage, and they won't ever walk again, talk, or be able to, you know, it's a horrendous disease, and they actually class it as an ultra rare disease because of the amount of cases. I think there's around about 300 cases known now. And I think that's what's so frustrating. It's really hard to accept, is that how can something be so ultra rare when there are 300 cases? Yeah, you know, it's and it is known of. And what's it's really strange is we didn't, when we left the hospital, and I'll go back to sort of what happened overnight. We weren't able to go back to meet the doctors and the neurologists that treated Grayson until I believe it was the end of June, end of July, because of COVID. So we were sent away from the hospital with no real understanding of what had happened to our son. We spent the evening with him on that Friday night, and obviously bearing in mind we only saw him at 10:30 and we weren't allowed to be by his bedside because of COVID. And they said to us, I'm really sorry, we can't give you a place here in the hospital. So they dragged a mattress into the staff room floor, and that's, we slept on the staff room floor. But the caths weren't open. They managed to find us like an egg sandwich from somewhere, but nowhere was open. And they said, if we're honest with you, we should really be sending you home. But I think at that point they knew the severity of what was happening. And we managed to, I don't know how, but we managed to get a couple of hours sleep. I think it was just pure exhaustion. And when we woke up, we went to see Grayson, and you could tell that he had deteriorated. And the nurse that was overseeing him, and I will always envision this lovely nurse, she had just returned from maternity leave herself, and I felt horrendous that she was having to treat my baby, and she had a newborn sat at home herself, and that must have been so tough for her. And I always think back to her, and I'm sorry that she had to do that. And she said to us, he's had a really, really good night, but he's, and his blood pressure dropped slightly, but his eyes were no longer dilated. And then the lovely Irish doctor came in, and she said to us, do you know what that means? And I said, no, but I kind of knew. And they said, we're really sorry, but medically we're taking this decision out of your hands. It's fully taken over Grayson's brain, and we believe that there is now swelling that started to take place. And they said, we're going to take him down for another CT scan to just be sure of that, but we believe that's what's happened. And they did that, and yes, it came back that there was various parts that had now started to swell, and it started to swell in other various areas. So they said our options were to let it take its, you know, let it take its toll, and he'll decide when it's enough, or we control that ourselves. And we decided that we, as his parents, had to make that decision for him. We didn't want him to be in any, I know he wasn't in any pain, but we didn't want him to be in any pain, and we didn't want it to take any more of him as such. It was really hard, because when we were there, the evening before, I was sort of reading his favourite book off by heart, as I did all the time, Follow That Tiger. And I was singing to him. And when I was doing that, his heart rate was raising. So he knew we were there, which was just really lovely. And I suppose it's quite comforting to know that he knew we was there. And our family came the next day. They weren't allowed in the hospital. They weren't allowed to see Grayson because of COVID. So they just literally had to be in the car park. So we went down and we told them what we were having to do. So it was my sister and Craig's sister, and then Craig's dad and my mum. So I don't have a dad. My dad passed away, and Craig's mum's passed away as well. So they were in the car park, and we told them what was happening. And we went upstairs, and they had moved Grayson into a beautiful little side room. And it was painted on the wall with trees, and it had squirrels and birds. And it was one of Grayson's absolute favourite things. You know, we had in our dining room, we had sort of a full glass window, and we would always eat at the dining table, and we would sit there and we would talk about the birdies, and this, we called them squiggles, because we would always have squirrels and birds in our gardens, and he just loved it. He, you know, at 10 months old, he was saying like, bye birdies and mama and dada. So the birdies, it just felt so, you know, so comforting for us. And they brought the lovely box in, and they did the handprints and all of that. And we played some music, and they took all of the tubes out, and we held him and we told him how much we loved him. And he lasted 20 minutes. He breathed for 20 minutes and his heart continued for 20 minutes, and they kept coming in and, you know, testing. And they was like, no, he's still with you. Which they were surprised, you know, he was a fighter. And then we laid him down and we literally had to get our belongings and go. We weren't allowed to stay. We were sent home with some leaflets of basically what you do next. And that was that, basically. We came home, that was on the Saturday. So his death was at 4:15, and we came home. The Sunday was our first Mother's Day. And then Monday we were put in a national lockdown.
Losing Grayson at that point, just, it's just insult to injury, isn't it? I can't even contemplate how that must have been for you. And all the restrictions were in place. And then thinking about having to go home afterwards, and the whole world is going into lockdown. Right. And you've just lost your son.
At a time when you need to be scooped up, you know, ordinarily you would be scooped up and looked after. And it's already a very, very isolating thing to happen, isn't it?
Because,
you know, like you say, you're in these side rooms and you're waiting and you're on your own quite a lot. How did you guys get through that? Like, what did you do to kind of, was there any support available for you?
So, I mean, we broke the rules.
Good.
We had to.
Yeah, of course.
I say we broke the rules when our parents came down. You know, the day we came home was beautiful sunshine, and I still to this day think that Grayson brought that to us.
Yes.
So, you know, they would come into the gardens, you know, and that sort of thing. And it was, you know, I don't know what the world is like when you... when your baby dies in normal times. All we have to go by is COVID. It was just horrendous, you know, every follow-up that we had. So the post-mortem, it all had to be done via a phone call, recorded. The funeral arrangements, we weren't allowed to the funeral directors. So that was, I suppose, most probably one of our hardest things to deal with, is putting your trust into someone that you've never met. Yeah. And, you know, we was trying to register Grayson's death. I mean, that was hard enough as it was, because when we called the registry office where he was actually registered, which was obviously our local registry office, we explained everything that had happened, and they were like, oh, because of COVID, we're not really sure. You're supposed to come in and you need to sign it in person, but obviously you can't do that. And I was like, but we need to register his death to start everything else. Yeah. And it was just to-ing and fro-ing of, well, you can't register his death. We need you to basically organize a funeral directors. And I was like, how do you start that process, you know? How do I even do that? And we called a lovely funeral directors, actually, that my mum works in a care home that they use. And I suppose, it once again, it's trying to claw at those only bits of comfort that you can. And my mum said, you know, they're a really lovely funeral directors, and I spoke to the owner, and he was just amazing. He just said, right, you can't do this. He said, what is being asked of you, and the fact that the world is falling apart and nobody knows what, you know, we was being told that we can't register our son's death, which means we can't start the funeral arrangements because we have to be there in person to sign all the death certificates, and we can't do that, and we're not allowed to go back to the hospital to collect the death certificates because they won't allow us in the hospital. So how do we do this? And I was explaining it to this lovely man, and he just said, give me your contact details for John Radcliffe, give me the details for the registry office. And he just took it all from us, and he was like, brilliant, you can't be doing this, he said. So he sort of did it all, and he came back to us, and he said, I'm going, and he drove from where we lived in Bucks to John Radcliffe to collect the death certificate, to then bring them back to his funeral directors, and we went and collected them, sort of doorstep sort of collection. Yeah. And then we were able to then No, sorry, he brought them back. Then he took them to the registry office, which was back in Oxford. And then he went back to the hospital to collect Grayson. And I just, there was one thing that stuck with us. And he said, I'm going to collect your baby boy and he's going to be safe with us. Because there's nothing worse for a parent that has completely lost control of everything that a parent should do to not know where your baby is. And I didn't know where he was. And, you know, we opted for quite a limited post-mortem because the full post-mortem was a lot to take. Yeah. And it was a lot to take in. And we just need him to be somewhere where we know he's being cared for. And he was just a lovely, lovely man. And Grayson went back to the funeral directors and we arranged all the funeral by a phone call, you know, because we couldn't be there in person. And we took down the things that we wanted to be with Grayson and clothes and things for him, which was his little mustard tracksuit. Mustard is our colour. And he had his Norm with him, his little monkey. And they, you know, they did say that you can come and see Grayson if you wish in the Chapel of Rest. And we decided not to, but my mum wanted to. Yeah. So my mum went there and she read him a book. And it was just nice knowing that the last, I suppose the last person that saw him had done that for us. And I will forever be grateful for my mum for doing that. And we had his funeral and there could only be 9 people at his funeral, so it was recorded and sort of like live streamed so people could be there with us. And we opted for a cremation, and at first a burial wasn't even on the cards because of COVID and the amount of deaths. They weren't doing burials. And actually, now thinking about it, we both probably wouldn't have opted for a burial anyway, because we didn't, he was only 10 months old, we didn't have a set place. So he's home with us now, and we find a lot of comfort in that.
Losing a child is something that parents, it's not the order of things, it's not what should happen, but then for that, just exactly as the whole place is going into the lockdown, and you really got this sense last year, especially in March, and I feel this listening to your story, people were, they didn't know what to do. They were in freeze mode and they were like, I don't know how I can help here. And I can imagine in the hospital as well, from the moment you came into contact, obviously with the, sounds like amazing staff, both at your local hospital and then at John Radcliffe, you know, they were trying to navigate this completely new experience alongside probably just their hearts going out to you and Craig beyond belief. Wanting to do what, you know, what they could for you, and suddenly all these restrictions are swooping in. Such a surreal time on top of everything else. Such a bizarre, abstract time.
It was difficult because, as I said, you know, we didn't know what had really happened. You know, you're not taking anything in. You know, you just hear those words of, he's no longer here. We're taking that decision out of your hands. And at that point I said, I can't do this. Yeah. I can't do this. And the doctor looked at me and she said, you can. You brought him into this world and you will walk him out. And that's sort of it that sticks with me. And we did that. I don't know how, but we did. It was really tough, and I suppose seeking help was quite hard afterwards because of doctor's appointments were all over the phone. You know, I remember contacting the doctor when we got home and we were in need of help. You know, we both said to each other when we got in the lift to come down from John Radcliffe, we need help. Yeah. We can't do this. You know, the doctor's appointments were all over the phone, you know, just via the phone, and they just diagnosed us with antidepressants and sleeping tablets and you know, things like that. And eventually we got into touch with our main doctor at our doctor surgery, and he was great. He just said, I'm getting you in. I need to see you. And he, you know, he brought us in. And at that point, we'd had blood work done to see if we were genetic carriers. So he could see from the blood work that we didn't have COVID. And actually, it turned out that Grayson didn't have COVID as well. They got his results back and he didn't have COVID. So, it's getting help after that was a while. You know, we eventually found a counsellor who we're still seeing now, Jenny Thomas, who set up Child Bereavement UK, and she's just been incredible. And that was through a little local charity that funded counselling support for bereaved parents. And it's just been, it has been amazing, the support that we've received.
And it's so important to reach out for that support, isn't it?
Yes.
And kind of, you know, to access those charities and you know, get as much help as you can, really.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But you've also offered support as well, Faye, because you and Craig obviously have started Grayson's Legacy Support.
Yes,
you've got a
yes.
beautiful website where other bereaved parents can go to. Other bereaved parents of any sort, but especially who've experienced rare disease like you have, is something that you... obviously, and Craig, understandably, are incredibly passionate about. And you also work closely with Rosie's Rainbow Fund and Teddy's Wish. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, yes. So Rosie's Rainbow Fund is the fund or the charity that actually funded our counselling. So Jenny works with Rosie's Rainbow as well as many other charities. And it was funded counselling, which actually, as a bereaved parent... And COVID, we most probably couldn't have afforded it ourselves. You know, those financial struggles are, you know, that's just one thing that you don't need to be dealing with when you are
Absolutely.
A bereaved parent.
Yeah.
And Teddy's Wish fund exactly the same. They fund counselling support, and Jenny also works with Teddy's Wish as well. And they also fully fund research into child illnesses and, baby loss. And they also fully fund retreats, which we were very grateful to be able to attend last year. So when the lockdown was lifted, we attended a retreat from Teddy's Wish, and it gathers bereaved parents together, and we did various activities during the day. So a mindfulness practice, or you could go into the walled gardens and take pictures of all the flowers and, you know, just be... there, or you go on a really beautiful country walk. And we did a really great just using magazine cutouts and explaining where you are, so just using different ways, I suppose, to explain where you are as a person and what you've been feeling, and just connecting with other bereaved parents. And actually, that's where I met Tawny. Retreat along with a lot of other parents that we've actually been in constant contact with. And it was just incredible. So what we wanted to do for Grayson's Legacy Support Trust was basically join that team, you know. And I suppose it's our way of parenting Grayson. You know, that's the only thing that we can do for him now, is to spread his smile, to raise awareness for A&E and rare diseases, and to support other bereaved parents, because we know what that's like. So so we've been doing some various fundraisings, and I think last year it was roughly around about 10,000 that we had raised.
Fantastic.
Which was great. So we had a friend do an ultra marathon. He ran 100 kilometers in one day.
Wow.
I mean, just incredible. And then we had our beautiful nephew Ollie, who is 9 years old, and he climbed Mount Snowden. So there's just been various little bake-offs and things. And what we have actually now been able to do, it's not yet been released, but we have been able to raise enough to fully fund the residential retreat for Teddy's Wish this year. So that's £5,000.
Oh, well done.
And it's a whole weekend, so hopefully with COVID they can do it for a whole weekend, whereas we just had sort of a one day because we couldn't stay over. But that's now fully funded from Grayson's Legacy Support Trust in memory and of honour of Grayson, which is great. And later on this year we are going to also be fully funding two courses for mindfulness for grief with Tawny, which is just amazing. So it's just trying to think of the things that we can do. I mean, I've just recently done a mindfulness course myself with Amy Polly, and I met Amy through the Baby Loss Awareness Month that Tawny had carried out for Teddy's yes. Wish. Yes. It's just been amazing. You know, it's really, really helped me in my everyday. And I've seen that myself. I've just thought, you know, this is something that we could help, you know, we could offer parents. So yeah, so we're going to be doing that later on in the year. Amazing. So yeah, and we've started to reach out with our merchandise as well. So we released our bottles. Oh, logo.
I saw those on the website, but they were sold out.
Yeah, so we've got the tumblers are on at the moment. Fantastic. So we've got about 14 yeah. tumblers. And obviously the yellow is us.
It's such a lovely colour, actually. I saw them and thought, oh, what a nice colour.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just obviously merchandise is it's more about the sort of the brand awareness and of then course, yeah. you know, raising awareness, because people will go, well, what's that logo? Yes. You know, that sort of thing. So, and we've had little cards printed with a QR code, so they can just literally show them a card, they can scan it, and it will take them through to the website. So yeah, it's been a journey that we never obviously thought that we would ever be on, but the support has just been incredible, you know, absolutely incredible. And like you say, it does take that reaching out, but with lockdown, that was, we literally felt like we had just been punished. You know, it was like, go yes. home, sit in your four walls of your house that's got everything of your child in it. Oh, you know, yeah, we came home to the towels on the floor, the travel cot up, his toys out, his high chair, and it just felt like we were being punished. You know, that's where you need to stay with nobody around you. And we kind of just had to go, right, what are we going to do with this? You know, how are we going to continue parenting Grayson, and yes. what can we do?
And you're so beautifully carrying Grayson with you through your lives. Mm. And yeah. you should be so proud of yourself from what you've created with Grayson's legacy, because think about all the people you're touching who, and you're absolutely right, you're their tribe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And being able to have what you're offering, all of the things that you and Craig have put your energy in. Let's bring Craig into this too, because I know that we're talking to you, Faye, but he's a huge part of this.
Absolutely.
And you're both Grayson's parents. And through doing what you do, that's Grayson. He's doing that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he gives us that, you know, he gives us that strength. And everyone always says, how are you so strong? I don't know how. But you don't know you're that strong until you really need to be. You know, and of course we will always have our moments where we don't want to get out of bed. And, you know, there were some really, really dark times at the beginning. And, you know, but once again, that by talking about it, it breaks that taboo down. Because as you quite rightly said, at the beginning, you know, it's not the norm. You know, we are brought into this world of you grow up, you meet somebody, you have a baby, and it's beautiful and it's easy, and you die before your children, and you've lived a full life. Grayson never even got to that point. And for me, it was like, well, we just didn't recognize the world, and we've literally had to learn to walk again.
Yes.
You know, it strips you of everything that you believe, and it strips you of everything that you know, and you don't ever. And I think one of the hardest things is you don't recognize yourself at all.
What you're doing right now is just so important. And going back to what Lex said about, you know, you're creating a space like to hold other people and being their tribe, you know, baby loss is still such a taboo subject, isn't it? And it can be like clients that we work with find it so isolating, and, you know, people don't know what to say, and so often they don't say anything. But you know, you want to still talk about your baby and share stories, and, you know, so it's so nice that you're providing that space for people as well.
Yeah, it's like you say, we just don't want anyone to ever feel alone, you know, and you can't say that enough. Saying nothing is worse than just saying, I'm really sorry, I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
You know, we're not expecting you to have, you know, we're not built with the vocabulary and the understanding of knowing how to deal with this. And that's what it's trying to, you know, that's what you try to get over to everybody, is that we don't want you, and we don't need you to know what's the right thing to say, because there is no right to say. Yeah. You know, the worst thing has happened. So, and at this point, I always say it is, you can't say anything that will hurt me as much as I have been, you know. Nothing can tear us down any more than we have been, you know. It's and also what it's hard, but and it's a hard thing to accept, but it takes the bereaved to be the ones that step forward and say, it's okay for you to talk about my baby, it's okay for you to mention them, and it's okay to not know what to say, but please don't distance yourself from us.
That's really good advice, actually, to kind of to reach out and say like, almost kind of what's the word, like set your bound, not boundaries, but you know, let people know that it's okay, I guess. That's the
thing. I remember I think I've mentioned this beforehand, but it's just something that really stuck with me over the years. Is I remember Nigella Lawson, who quite famously back in the 90s, I think it was, lost her sister and her husband within months of each other to cancer. And she wrote she said, controversial as it is, you know, obviously her cookbooks, she wrote a whole section called Food for a Funeral. And she wrote these beautiful recipes, and she says, just make this and leave it on someone's doorstep who is going through hell and back. And just let them know you've got them.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the moment's right. But I remember it really stuck with me, because, of course, you get these books full of all the happy celebration times. But there, you know, there's nothing like grief or bereavement to feel like you need to be completely scooped up by your people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, we unfortunately that was taken away from us. But, you know, we're very fortunate in the fact that we just had family that just went, fuck this.
Yes.
I'm coming round. You know, I had my one of my best friends, bless her. And so she was heavily pregnant with her first baby. And beautiful Otto came on the day of Grayson's funeral. I just think that it was a massive sign, and I do find, you know, real comfort in that. Mm. And she called and she said, I don't know what to say. And I said, that's fine. Yeah. That's absolutely okay. And I said, you know, COVID's hit and I can't get a delivery slot and I need to clean. And, you know, for me, it was like, I need to clean. I need a bacterial of the handles. And she just came and she just delivered a box of cleaning products and she just put them on my doorstep and drove away. And I just was so grateful for that.
Yeah.
You know, I was so grateful for bleach, because to me, I just needed to be doing something, you know.
Yes.
And you know, I had another friend that came and dropped a coloring book on the doorstep, and some that dropped, like, say, a meal, and the neighbor dropped around a cake, and it was just what you needed. And they still found a way, even with COVID and it being so fresh and raw, and of just going, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm just going to do it.
Which is so brilliant.
Yeah.
Leading on from that, we always like to finish by asking our guests, if you could sort of share some words or a little bit of advice to another parent who's bereaved and, you know, grieving the loss of a baby or child, what would you like to say to them, if anyone's listening?
First of all, I'm so sorry that you have joined this club that no parent wishes to be a part of. You're not alone. Your journey and your story is your own, and you won't find anybody. As a bereaved parent, you search for answers and you long to find people. That's what we did in our early stages, of people that have experienced it. And what you actually do is you open your heart to everyone's grief, you know. You take it on because you feel their pain, not exactly their pain, because their pain is their pain and your pain is your pain. No two stories and no two losses and deaths are the same. It's yours, and that's a part of you that will always remain yours. But there are so many people out there to reach out to. There's lots of different resources. Don't ever feel that if you've been turned away or you didn't get anywhere with the first call of help, that that's it, because it's not. It comes in all different forms, books, different charities and trusts, socials. You know, there are so many different places out there. So just don't give up. You're not alone.
Amazing. And we'll make sure that we put all the links to your charities and any others in the show notes so that people can reach out. And thanks so much, Faye, for coming and talking to us and sharing your gorgeous boy with us today. It's been really lovely to talk to you. Thanks once again to Faye for joining us today and talking so honestly about the life and death of her baby boy, Grayson.
If you or someone you know has been affected by baby loss, please look in our show notes where we have added links to charities and organisations that can offer help and support. Take care and see you next time on Notes from the Mother Box.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.